Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Don Tatson, City Council member and former mayor of Lafayette. Our moderator for tonight's program is Lisa Vorderbruggen, political reporter and columnist for the Contra Costa Times, Bay Area News Group, and Media News. Now I have the honor of introducing tonight's speaker, Congressman John Garamendi, who took office in November 2009, 35 years after his first successful election. After graduating from UC Berkeley and Harvard, John and his wife, Patty, served as volunteers in the Peace Corps in Ethiopia. John was elected to the State Assembly in 1974 and to the State Senate in 1976, where he served for 14 years and became Senate Majority Leader. In 1991, John became California's first elected insurance commissioner. He protected homeowners devastated by the Oakland Hills fire by forcing insurance companies to pay fully for rebuilding destroyed homes. In 1995, President Bill Clinton appointed him as Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Interior. John spearheaded efforts to resolve water disputes in California and negotiated the purchase of the Headwaters Forest. Most recently, John was Lieutenant Governor of California. As a member of the University of California Board of Regents and trustee for the California State University System, John served as a leading advocate to hold the line on student fee increases and argued for increased investment in education. Please welcome Congressman John Garamendi.
Thank you so very, very much, and thank you for attending tonight. The Commonwealth Club has always been one of my favorite places to speak and occasionally attend in the audience. So let's have some fun tonight. Let's go round and round on questions, which I will like to get to as soon as we possibly can. I also want to thank the voters of the 10th Congressional District for giving me a fabulous, marvelous, wonderful opportunity to represent this area. I absolutely love being in Congress. I've done a lot of things, as the introduction would say. I've been in public policy and public life for more than 35 years. How's that sound? But this is really the best of it. Others have been good. Being insurance commissioner was really good. I love to wake up in the morning and by 8 o'clock being sued by some insurance company for making them obey the contracts that they had written with us. But we're dealing now with really important public policy. What's going on in Congress is absolutely fundamental to the well-being of each and every one of you and the rest of every person in America and really around the world. And I'm right there, right in the middle of it, and able to use those 35 years, whatever I've learned over those years, to inform not only myself but my colleagues and to engage in the debates about where we're going as a nation, how we're going to deal with the issues that confront us. And there are a bunch of them. There are so many issues out there that it is a full-time agenda. And the picking and choosing among the menus of the issues is one of the problems that my staff has with me. Because I want to deal with all of the pieces of the puzzle. I want to deal with what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq and how are we going to deal with these international issues. What about Africa? What about the issues of the third world? How are we going to deal with the crisis of oil, healthcare, insurance issues? So I try to get into it all. And along the way, I'm having fun. And I'm really enjoying this district. It is a fabulous district, a very, very interesting one, one in which we have some of the greatest research in the entire world around this district. The Lawrence Livermore Lab, Sandia Labs, the Berkeley Labs, University of California and the Laboratory on Biogenetics here in the Walnut Creek area, and then just to the north of the district, literally on the border of the district, the University of California, Davis. Our future is going to be found in that research. So, it's fun. And then there are a lot of other issues that confront us here in the district, educational and so forth. But what I want to talk to you about, and I'm going to frame this issue as one of national security. And everybody says national security, oh my God, terrorism. Yes. But it's more than that. It's far more than that. The issues of national security that I'd like to talk to you about today are energy policy and healthcare policy. Let's take the last first, healthcare policy. We have a problem, partially solved by the legislation that was passed a couple of months ago, but not completely so. The nature of the problem is that the healthcare system in the United States is consuming an ever larger piece of our overall economy, money that we need for a variety of issues, education, research, economic development, planting equipment, marketing, all those things that create a robust society and social justice, is moving more and more into the healthcare sector. And so the reform that was passed deals with this at least in part. And as we look at what's happened over the last couple of dozen years, we see the more and more we spend, the more and more people that are uninsured. Companies are unable to afford the policy, so they drop the health insurance. Individuals can't buy health insurance. Health insurance companies are more and more searching for the bottom line and the dollar and less about what's going on with the consumer. It's profits before people. The reforms that have passed deal with this in a good way, but not a complete way. It's taken us in America to a new and better plateau, a system that is based on the existing American health policy systems, of private insurance, government insurance, a plethora of providers. Over time, the reform will tend to lessen the chaos in the system. It's not going to happen immediately. But there's some very, very important things in the healthcare reform that are immediately available to Americans. The insurance reform specifically. The health insurance industry has found more ways to harm people than you could possibly imagine. But I don't have to imagine it. I was the insurance commissioner. And I know what they were up to. I know about their denial of claims because you didn't disclose that when you were a teenager you had acne. You know, pre-existing conditions. Denial of claims because of a pre-existing condition called post-event underwriting. If you happen to be a woman, you had a pre-existing condition. Yeah, you might get pregnant. Oh, my goodness. Or something other than that. If you're 50 years of old and you lost your job, you lost your health insurance, chances are that you were not going to be employable because you're likely to be expensive. And employers look at that and they go, hire a 50-year-old, and it's going to cost me more money, and therefore I'm going to look for somebody that's 25. These are very real things. All of those are outlawed. That kind of discrimination is outlawed. It will not be allowed in America again. And we tried to get most of this done when I was insurance commissioner. We were unable to overcome the power of the health insurance lobby. But we did now as a nation. So pre-existing conditions are gone. The kind of discrimination that takes place because you're a woman, that's gone. If you happen to have a baby and the baby has some sort of condition, that kid was uninsurable in the pre-reform era. If you happen to be a senior, Medicare continues. And in the reform, Medicare is made financially viable for another 7 to 9 years, and some say even more years than that, because of the reforms. The pharmaceutical donut hole, in which many, many seniors fall because they have expensive pharmaceuticals that they have to take, that's going to close over time. And this year, beginning next week actually, those seniors that are in that expensive regime of drugs that are in that donut hole where they have to pay 100%, they're going to get a $250 rebate check immediately. So these reforms are important and they're in place now. Down the line, we're going to see a change taking place in the way in which insurance is made available and sold. These are called exchanges. Actually, an idea that I put forth in 1991 when I was the insurance commissioner for the first time. Using an exchange, a marketplace, where you accumulate a large group of people, spread the risk, and therefore are able to take advantage of what is called insurance, which is the spreading of risk over a large population. If this thing is designed the way I think it should be, there'll be many, many different kinds of opportunities for people to get care in different ways. Everything from Kaiser, the big systems like Kaiser, to group practices, to programs like the Kaiser, like the Contra Costa County program. Sign up. It's possible. That should provide a great deal of downward pressure on prices because there'll be a real marketplace. Information will be available. Technology is coming online in insurance, and the reform pushes the technology. Patient records available. If any of you are in Kaiser, you know what the patient record system can do for you. You know, I'm a Kaiser person. I've been there for 35 years now. I can go to any Kaiser facility in America. They can punch in my number, and everything about my medical history is known. I don't have to start at the beginning. The cost savings will be enormous. You go into an emergency room now, and you're not part of that system, they're going to have to start at the beginning with blood tests and workups and everything else before they get to what the problem is that brought you there in the first place. These reforms are very, very important. For businesses, for small businesses, there's an immediate subsidy, a tax credit that's available. If you're buying insurance, you can get up to a 35% subsidy immediately if you have less than 10 employees, if you're buying the insurance. Eventually, that'll be a 50%. And then later, the full marketplace kicks in. It's not perfection, but it's a whole lot better of where we are now. And how does that fit into national security? The estimate by the Independent Congressional Budget Office is that in the next 9 years, it will reduce the American deficit by $138 billion. And in the year 2010 and 2020 and to 2030, over $1 trillion reduction, which means that the share of the total economy that goes into healthcare will begin to either hold steady or begin to shrink. That's important because that's a fundamental national security issue because it affects us personally in that when this reform is fully in place, most everybody in America, who's legally here, will be in an insurance system. That spreads the risk. No more free riders. No more the rest of us having to pay for the free riders that are in the system that show up at the emergency room without insurance. So all of us will be participating. That's not only the way to do it, but that's the fair way to do it. And that is a personal security issue for all of us. For the economy to be able to hold the cost steady and perhaps see it reduced, that is the share of the economy. That's also important for us because that will free up money that we need for education, for other systems that are crucial to our future. Second point I want to go to is our national security issue as it relates to energy policy. Our nation is in serious risk because of the energy policy that we've had for the last 100 years. It's an energy policy based on carbon. We've done everything we possibly can to encourage the use of carbon-based fuels, the result of which is oil blowouts, such as Deepwater Horizon, searching for oil in the more dangerous places of the world. Think about where we get our oil. We get our oil from the most dangerous places in the world. We get it from the Arctic. We get it from Saudi Arabia, eventually Iraq, Venezuela, Nigeria, the Gulf of Mexico. Katrina and the related storm shut down 30% of the energy for America just because of the hurricanes. And we now know that when you're drilling in deep water, you're running serious risks. And as we consume more and more oil, we're going to more and more risky places to get it. Now, on the other side, those of you that believe in climate change, as I do, and we pump more and more carbon into our atmosphere, we're putting our nation in serious jeopardy. It's been hypothesized that the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, and the oceans of the world will rise as a result of global warming. You might want to pay attention to Greenland. And if you really want to go afield, take a look at Antarctic and check the glaciers. The current planning in California is anywhere from 1 foot to 1 meter. Okay, 3 feet, 6 inches. 3 feet, 4 inches. That's a lot of sea level rise. You can kiss the Oakland Airport goodbye along with the San Francisco International Airport and the entire California Delta. This is a major question for us. We lose the Delta. We lose control of the water system. You start sucking salt water in Contra Costa County, Santa Clara County, everything south of Tracy, including Los Angeles. That's a problem. That is a fundamental national security risk. Why? Takes us back to energy policy. We have to change our energy policy. We cannot put this nation at risk, not only because of where we get the oil. Is there anybody doubt why we are in Iraq? We went there for a regime change? I think not. We went there because that's where the oil is. Okay? And why did we build a military base that's supposed to keep us there for God knows how many years and decades? Because that's where the oil is. That's a dangerous place. Our national security is at risk as long as we're dependent upon this. And by the way, some $10 to $15 billion of your money is continuing to subsidize the oil industry as if they need more subsidies. The most profitable industry in America has been the oil industry, followed by the pharmaceutical industry. And so on health care, we do not allow the government to negotiate for prices. And on oil, we continue to subsidize the oil industry. No. Shift that subsidy to the renewable technologies. Take that $15 billion and invest it in renewable technologies and research of all kinds, and do it for a century, and we will develop an energy industry as good as and far greener than a carbon-based energy system. It's going to take us a while. We're going to be with oil for some time. But we ought not continue to subsidize it. We ought not continue to do the most risky things in the world that have the potential of destroying ecosystems that are very, very important to us. Now, that's why I've introduced the West Coast Ocean Protection Act, which will permanently eliminate all new leases off the West Coast of America. My colleagues on the East Coast are saying the same thing. Not only does that lead to the protection of a very, very valuable resource called our coast, all the way from Washington to Mexico, it also, if we were to do this on both the East Coast and the West Coast, forces us into the green renewable energy regime. Because we can't go after oil in those places. We're going to have to get the energy. Let's get it from renewables. And by the way, if we're going to subsidize renewables, as we must and as we should, then those renewables ought to be built in America. It's our tax money. It ought not be used to subsidize solar panels from China. It ought to be used to subsidize solar panels from, Pittsburgh and Antioch. Let's bring it home. One of the more, we're getting close. I'll wrap up with this. I have a time policeman over here that's looking at me saying it's time to wrap. I'm going to wrap with this way. I represent some of the biggest wind farms in America, the Altamont Pass and the wind farms over in Solano County. I was over there touring the wind farms one day. I asked the question of the fellow that represents one of the big companies. I said, where's this machine made? It's 400 feet tall. The blades are 150 meters across. Wow. Where's it made? I knew the answer. He said, well, the blades are made in Europe. We used to make them in Colorado, but we decided we'd rather import them. And I said, how about the turbine, the machinery in there? Well, that's brought from Europe. And I said, the tower? Well, the tower is huge, 400-foot steel tower. Oh, we bring that in from Korea. I go, that's interesting. And you want my help with the Air Force on their radar systems? Oh, yeah, we've got problems with the Air Force, the Travis Air Force Base. And unless they allow us to somehow, the radars get confused when things are going round and round. They think it might be a bird. It might be an incoming missile. They don't know what it is. And so they say, wait a minute. We can't do any more wind turbines over there until we figure out this radar system. I said to him, you want my help with the Air Force, right? Yes. I said, I'm going to tell you this. when you come back to me and you tell me that this next machine, this next turbine is built in America, you'll have my help with the Air Force. They said, well, you can't do that. And I said, oh, you want to bet I can do that? I am doing it. And I'm telling them very plain and clear. So SMUD, Sacramento Municipal Utility District, which incidentally, the PG&E is outlandish with what's on the ballot, Proposition 16. Come on. Come on. Anyway, that's another matter. The SMUD came back and said, we can't do that. And I said, okay, well, then I can't help you. They came back a month later and said, well, I tell you what, we've been able to get to 40%. And I said, let me know when you get to 100. We can do this. 20 miles away from those wind turbines is a POSCO steel plant in Pittsburgh, California. I just talked to the president today. He said, all right, we can't do that. We only do light steel. And I said, why can't you do the heavy? Well, we got to invest $1 million. Okay. POSCO steel is making those wind turbines, towers, in Korea and shipping them here on a barge. I'm unimpressed. We're going to build in America. We're going to rebuild the American manufacturing industry with our own money as we subsidize these new industries of the future. Okay, that's enough. Let's go to your Q&A. Lisa, what do you got for me?
Our thanks to John Garamendi, and I'm sure that time police is one of the nicer things he's called me. So we'll... No,
oh,
I'm just
Lisa,
I'm just kidding.
You know I love your articles.
I know, he does, he does. I am, as many of you know, the political columnist and writer for the Bay Area News Group and for the Contra Costa Times, and I'll be your moderator for our Q&A period. And we're going to get to your audience questions in just a few minutes. If we could have you folks line up behind the microphone if you have a question, and really don't be shy. You'll have to listen to my questions all evening. And John said to surprise him, but I don't think he really meant that. So if we could have folks come forward and get ready to ask your questions, we would ask that you ask a question and not give a speech. That's the congressman's job. So we'll see how that goes. And if we could start with you, sir.
Yes, John, this is not directly health, security, energy, but I think it affects our ability to accomplish those things. Is there anything that you can do through the federal legislative process as opposed to a constitutional amendment to offset the Supreme Court ruling that allows unlimited funding by corporations in the elective process?
Yes, a little. And in fact, we're probably going to deal with that in next week. Actually, this week, if not this week, then the following week. We're going to take a Republican idea, and that's called the solution for campaign finance reform is disclosure, immediate disclosure of where the money's coming from. They've been talking about that for a long time, and we said, well, that's pretty good. That's about the best we can do given the Supreme Court decision and the constitutional underwriting underpinnings of that. Interestingly enough, the Republicans now oppose their own idea. But we're going to try to move that. I think we have the votes for it, and it basically is basic disclosure. You can't hide behind the U.S. Chamber of Commerce if you happen to be Chevron or BP or whomever. You got to disclose where the money's really coming from, and you got to do it immediately. We think that that's about the best we can do because it's a very, very difficult situation, and it does open the door wide open. We'll also limit foreign companies from contributing. Right now, if you're not a legal resident or a citizen, you cannot participate in elections financially. Well, you can't vote either. And so we're just kind of extending that. If you're a foreign-owned company operating in the United States, such as BP, then you cannot participate. We think that'll pass muster also. We'll see. It's going to be up next week. Thank you for the question.
I'd like to follow up on that a little bit because disclosure is one of the things that I know many of us here have probably looked at opensecrets.org. There's lots of disclosure. Who has time to go through all that disclosure? How does that become meaningful to the public, and when it involves wading through names and lists and dollar amounts?
Lisa, it's your job. Get it done.
You're right. I wanted to give a plug for my business.
Actually, there are interest groups that do that, and they search through the databases. And part of this is to make sure that this is done online in a database that's accessible, so that
right.
the kind of mix and match can take place.
Right. So they're not going to be on index cards in the basement of a Washington building.
No. It's got to
be the Form 700 financial disclosures are. That was a surprise.
Let's move
I think
on.
I actually surprised you. Let's go with your question,
right.
sir.
Well, you've already commented on this in various ways, but I was just wondering, in an era where it's the norm to see the large majority of durable goods and consumer products sold in the U.S. are products of China, could you please comment on the economic, national security, and employment issues, ramifications of this, and what can we do to change that to have a viable future where we must continue to need and employ citizens who aren't PhDs or educated high-tech but limited numbers of workers?
Yeah, an excellent question. Thank you very much for it, because that is kind of the result of much of what we do. One of the major problems with the balance of trade is energy. I mean, it's costing us hundreds of billions of dollars a year to import oil. So I was talking about that earlier. That balance of trade issue comes about, we have to borrow money to continue our consumption. And it's not just oil. It's suits. It's clothing. It's cars and so on and so forth. So what we need to do is to shift our policies here. And we need to shift in two ways. I talked about the subsidies. Listen, this is our tax money that's being used to subsidize foreign imports. Give me a break. Come on. Now, it happens that China has a policy that we ought to replicate. And that is, if it's government money, then it's going to be built in China. Plain and simple. That's their policy. I think it's a good policy, and I think we ought to do it here. Fine. And later, I guess I'm going to get ahead of my press release, but I am on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee. And I'm the only Northern Californian on that. And I'm going, well, I'm not sure why I'm the only one, but I am. And I'm really concerned. We spend about $4 to $5 billion of our tax money every year buying trains, buses, light rail vehicles, things of that sort. Very, very few of which are made in America. I think AC Transit has something to do with this area. Yes, it does. Well, for the last 20 years, they have ignored the fact that there is a bus manufacturer in their district from which they have refused to buy buses. Instead, they buy buses from Belgium. I'm going, whoa, wait a minute. So what are we going to do about the $4 or $5 billion of our federal tax money that's going to pay for these buses? If I have my way, and I intend to, it's going to be build it in America and buy it from America. Period.
If you could come to the microphone, sir.
We can have a dialogue, yeah. But yes, no, you need to incentivize. Part of it is to incentivize the manufacturer by saying the money's available. Part of this is the short-term contracts. We need a long-term contract so that you can amortize the cost of the manufacturing and the engineering and the plant and equipment. That needs to be amortized. We're working on those things. $4 to $5 billion a year is enough to set up a new manufacturing industry in America. Now, the high-speed rail, which is not the favorite of the Contra Costa Times, I've noticed from their editorials, but nonetheless is moving forward, has to be built in America. So Ray LaHood, the Secretary of Transportation, comes in, introduces himself, because I am the only Northern California on the Transportation Committee, introduces himself, says, we're going to really build a high-speed rail in California. You got $8 billion. There's going to be more coming in the future, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, terrific. And he says, and it's going to be built in America. I said, that's great. Is it going to be built in California? He looks at me and goes, huh? I'm going, yeah, it's going to be built in California. He said, well, America. And I said, why don't you build it in California? After all, this is a California train. I said, where would we build? And I said, how about the NUMMI plant? He goes, NUMMI? Well, now he knows. Now he knows about NUMMI, and his troops are out here searching around. And maybe it's possible. But you've got to have a public policy that says build it in America. It's our money. It's going to be spent here. If it's somebody else's money, you can spend it wherever they want.
Okay
you're the follow-up?
Very, very quickly.
A new slogan might be think global, build local.
Well, I like that. And what I really want to do is to walk into a Target store someday and see Made in America.
Yes, ma'am.
A brief comment about what you said, full disclosure on Proposition 16. We're watching all these commercials over and over again about it. And at the very bottom, in pale gray letters, it says major funding by PG&E. But you can hardly see it. So in your full disclosure, it would be nice if you said make it in black. But my question
is... The first 5 seconds of the commercial, yeah. Right across the screen.
Yes. But my question is... you have power to do something about this, and everyone's trying to rein in the Medicare costs. Well, my husband and I, unfortunately, have experience with this, and we see, multiply ours by millions of people, how absolutely millions of dollars could be saved. I'll give you just one example. In the hospital, we had an EKG test. Less than a week later, we went to the cardiologist, and they insisted on repeating the test. Nothing had happened in the interim, but they have the equipment there, and they can bill for that. We have so many examples. Every time we open it up, we look. And I am sure without cutting any services and without cutting payments to doctors, it would be wonderful if you could begin to investigate the enormous savings that are right there by being squandered.
What if I told you the legislation... those 2,000 pages that people say, oh, my God, couldn't possibly. In those 2,000 pages is a series of reforms that deal specifically with what you're talking about. And you're absolutely correct. Yeah, just too long. Well, you know, healthcare is really complex, and there are a lot of pieces to it, and it's a very comprehensive reform. It covers a lot of different things. Here's what it does in that specific area that you've described. It moves, it begins the process. Actually, it doesn't begin. At the beginning was about 20 years ago in California with capitated payment systems. In other words, you pay for wholeness, not for individual specific procedures, but rather for the whole person. That's called a capitated system. It moves the total Medicare system more into the capitated system. And it does that in a variety of ways. I won't go into detail, but I'll just short-circuit it there so that you're paying for, let's say you go in for a heart issue. You're not paying for the stent and the catheter and the needles and everything separately, but you pay for the whole procedure. Or alternatively, you pay for wellness, which is another piece of it. There's a major piece of this to move the payment system towards wellness, keeping people healthy. Now, this has been done in California for some 25 years. We call it the HMO system. A lot of problems with it, but nonetheless, it's modeled in moving us in that direction so that the incentives are to keep you healthy rather than to do more and more things. There's also a whole series of things that have to do with durable equipment and all of the fraud associated with that. During the Bush administration, they actually reduced the enforcement for Medicare and then whined about fraud. Come on. So there's a lot of money. There's almost $500 million that go directly into fighting fraud. And some of it is particularly in the durable medical equipment side of it. And I'll never forget, this is one more thing back to Build and Buy America. Some guy came up to me at a town hall. I think you were there, Lisa. Came up afterwards. He picked up his cane and he started going like this. And I'm going, oh, he's going to whack me. He said, look at this, look at this. And I looked at it and he picked it up and he said, see that? And I said, you know, okay, let me put my glasses on and look at it. And he said, made in China. He said, why in the hell is the American government buying me a cane made in China? Can't we have an American cane? I go, oh, good idea. Takes us back to the previous issue. So all these things come together. And the legislation, the healthcare legislation, as comprehensive as it is, deals specifically with Medicare, moving seniors into a different payment mechanism rather than simple fee-for-service into these other kinds of systems, and also deals with a lot of fraud in the system. I talked earlier about medical information technology. That's an important element in this process, because you wouldn't have to go in for multiple echocardiograms and the like. You get one, it lasts for a period of time, it's readily available wherever you happen to go.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so you just mentioned town hall meetings, and you've already held, I think, 8 or 9 so far in your short time in office, and I think that's more than your predecessor, Congresswoman Tauscher, held in her last 4 or 5 years in office. But my question is has to do with the House Armed Services Committee. You just were appointed to it, and I wanted to know what your priorities are going to be. I think you're about the only Northern Californian or one of the few on the committee.
Yeah, I was just appointed to. I hadn't expected to be. Generally speaking, freshmen don't get to be on the Armed Services Committee, the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and the Science and Technology Committee. But I am. And I don't know. The speaker said, I want you there. And I said, okay. This is my second week at it. And my God, they can spend a lot of money in the military. The first week was they moved the defense authorization bill out of committee. And, you know, I'm there at the end of it, and I'm looking, whoa, $700 billion. I go, I didn't have time to say why and what for. And, you know, the process of working with people is really important. Don't get in their face day one. You know, you just don't want it. You want to be working with people. You got to understand what's going on. And clearly I didn't know what was in the bill. Sat down to committee, and as I was about to cast my very first vote, I got a call from my daughter that said my wife's mother had died, so I left and missed the committee entirely. I'm going to learn. I'm going to learn that business of the military, and I've always raised questions. Why are we doing this? Why? What's this all about? And in the days ahead, in this month of June, a really big question is going to come before me, and that's what are we going to do about Iraq and Afghanistan? What are we going to do about that $100 billion? And I'm going, we're laying off teachers all across America. What would $100 billion do? National security. This is going to be a wrestling. I'm going to wrestle with this one in my mind. Our soldiers are there. It's going to be interesting. I am not at all happy with what we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. I've got real serious doubts about about our policies there. And I think the president made a big mistake not coming to Congress before he sent the troops and asking for the money before he sent the troops. I've always had problems with that over, and the presidents do this all the time. Send the troops, and then what are you going to do? Leave them there without food, ammunition, so on and so forth. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Yes. What's that 30 mean? 30 seconds or 30 minutes? Minutes. Oh, we're going to have fun. Let's go.
Thanks for coming tonight. I have, I think, like a lot of people, I'm really saddened that so many people seem to have despair that their government can do anything or that it's corrupt. And in the wake of BP, we read, some of us are junkies and read how much lobbyists are being paid and how many lobbyists how many lobbyists are focused on you, for example, about energy, about healthcare, about finance. What difference can people make? How can we, on our side of it, be a force to try and counterbalance lobbyists as you're trying to make it and make legislation that's going to be for our benefit? And in the wake of BP, how viable do you think it is that we'll be able to develop an energy policy that where people have a wake-up call and drill, baby, drill isn't, going to be the law?
Let's take those two things. Basically, what can you do? Well, you're doing it tonight. You're paying attention. You know, I've got a voice. I'm your voice in Congress. Yeah, I'm one of 435, okay, but I've got a pretty loud voice, and I need to know what you think, and I need to, when I'm right on the policy, you agree with me? Terrific. You know, speak up and say he's doing the right thing. When I'm wrong, say I'm wrong. Engage, involve yourself, and you're doing it. The Commonwealth Club has a long tradition of doing that, and you're making the information available. You know, this will be broadcast, and I'm sure somebody's going to phone and give me hell about one or another things that I've said. That's fine. That's involvement. That's really important. You know, the clubs, Democratic, Republican Party, Tea Party, so that's fine. Get involved. You know, rant and rave and get involved. So what do you do? And by the way, you better vote. It's your privilege. And if you don't vote, what do they say? If you don't vote, don't complain. Okay. Look, I think tomorrow, Election Day.
Tomorrow is election day.
How many of you have voted absentee? Almost all. Yeah, me too. Yeah, I'm on an airplane out of here at 6 o'clock in the morning tomorrow before the poll. Well, I guess the polls have just opened. But yeah, you vote absentee, and almost all of you have. It's increasingly common in this district, which raises a political campaign problem, by the way. It's far more expensive when they have 30 days out you can vote.
I think 70% of everyone who casts a vote tomorrow will have done it in a mail ballot.
Yeah, and for campaigners, that means we've got to extend our advertising, which means we need more money.
30-day campaigns, yeah.
More money. So that becomes a cycle. So I'm all for, 2 weeks, not 4 weeks. I'm sorry, but it's expensive. Sir?
There seems to be a very anti-Washington, anti-incumbent view in the country.
I think that's really wrong.
And I'd appreciate it if you would talk to past, present, and future. Past, how has this happened to develop? I think we all kind of had ideas, but since you live with it, it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts. How big of a problem is it today, presently, and what do you see as far as the future for our country with this viewpoint seeming to take some root?
Well, first of all, in the larger future, to be unhappy with government is an American tradition. It goes right back to the very beginnings of America. You read the history about politics. I mean, the American public has a great deal of cynicism about government. Local, state, federal, I mean, it's been there forever. And in many respects, it's healthy. Well, when the Republicans are in power, I've got really deep cynicism about the way they're running the government, and the Republicans about the Democrats when they're in power and so forth. That's a healthy thing. The problem is when people simply cop out, don't pay attention, don't vote, and simply say a pox on all of them, and I'm going to go sit in my room and watch cartoons. It's when they leave the process that the problem really develops, and I think there's a lot of that going on. Being angry, listen, it's the healthcare debate was really messy. And you know how many times have we heard, "Don't watch sausage or laws being made." Okay, it was a messy, messy process. And a lot of give and take. That's the compromise that goes on in a democracy. Compromise. And, and one side screams and yells they're being ignored. The Democrats did that when they were out of power. Now the Republicans do it. That's fine. And incidentally, some reporter came up to me, Lisa, and said, this is in Washington. Well, you were here during the Clinton period. You've been around all these years. The partisanship is worse now than ever before. And I'm going, were you here in the last 5 years of the 90 decade? Now, that was a blood sport. I mean, there are special investigators and special persecutors all over the place in Washington. And it was just plain deadly. And this is just politics at its raucous best. That's just the way America is. You know, we're wrestling with policy. We're wrestling with fundamental directions of where the country's going. I spoke to two of them. The healthcare industry in America is 17% of our total economy. This is really important, and it affects each of us personally. The energy policy is crucial to this nation, and the wrestling back and forth and the tug and war of all these economic interests and the overall interest of our economy and where this country is going, this is really important stuff, so expect it to be down and intense and occasionally dirty. Hey. Think back to what happened before the Civil War. We're talking about really intense politics and so on and so forth through the American history. Get engaged. Don't cop out. Stay engaged.
I appreciate your being here tonight to answer questions.
Sure.
I spent 2 years with MacArthur in the Philippines and New Guinea. During the jungles there, I lost a lot of buddies. I'm not asking for a medal, but I am asking an answer for a few questions.
Sure.
One is, we're concerned about immigration. And it seems to me that one of the reasons we fought in the Philippines, New Guinea, and Europe is we saw our country being invaded. and we see it being invaded again. And this time with the cooperation of large corporations, military, the voters who don't understand the issues, and the government of Mexico, which is run by 16 billionaires. The richest man in the world, Carlos Sims, was in Washington. No, he was not in Washington. Calderon was in Washington last week addressing the House, as you know. Is that true?
Yes.
And he was complaining about the law in Arizona. And I understand he got a standing ovation. Were you one of those?
Actually, I was at my mother-in-law's funeral.
Okay. But you know what I'm discussing.
Sure.
And do you have any answer to the question of what's going to happen with these millions of people coming into this country?
Yes.
And here we have 12 million unemployed, and we're bringing 12 million into the country or giving them amnesty, or our administration would like to give them amnesty. To me, this is madness.
Yeah. Well, I think we need to go back and get a clear understanding of what comprehensive immigration reform is all about. Mm-hmm. It's comprehensive. The American immigration policy today is no policy at all.
Right.
I mean, it's a hodgepodge. There really isn't a rational policy on immigration. Mm-hmm. America has wrestled with immigration for almost two centuries now. And there have been times when the anti-immigrant mood has swept across America. And it's usually when the economy is down. Now, in California, we have a pretty abysmal history of bashing the most recent immigrant, some of whom were Americans from Oklahoma. And it usually is associated with the economy. When the economy is booming, we want to have our gardener and we want to have our house cleaner and we don't want to have to pay them much money and we're happy that they're Mexican. Okay? Now the economy's down and the table has turned. So what we need to do is to put in place a comprehensive immigration policy. Yes, we need to control our borders. There's no doubt that that's necessary for a variety of reasons. One is immigration. Other is just simple security policy, tax policy, on and on and on. So we need to secure our borders. That's one step one. It has to be done simultaneously with, you mentioned corporations, both big and small, hiring illegally. The laws are clear, but the enforcement is not, and the penalties are not really there for hiring by businesses, including homeowners. I'll never forget a debate I got on with two radical right-wing talk show hosts in Southern California going on and on about this. I was trying to explain a comprehensive policy, and they were going on and on, and I said, excuse me, just one question. Is your housekeeper and your gardener legal? It was incredible how fast I got off that show. I didn't last through we got to take an advertisement. They didn't invite me back. But the problem is widespread on employers. Okay? So that's a piece of the puzzle. The other piece of the puzzle is what do we do with the 12 million that are here? Many of whom have been here almost as long as you have. They've been here from the time they were children and they're 60 and 70 now. And for many, many reasons, they've not established their residency. What to do about it? They have family, kids, maybe even grandkids. So we need to be able to deal with that reality that many of these people have been here a long, long time, and they're part of our community. They're part of our economy. And so this is where the amnesty question comes in. It's a path to rationalize their presence. Are they here? Have they committed crimes? Have they a work record? Have they been paying Social Security? These are all fundamental questions that we need to take into account as we deal with the reality, not the political talk, get rid of the immigrants. I mean, you're looking at $100 million of advertising in California on this issue. None of it coming down to the reality of how do we deal with the fact that they're here. And they have been an important part of our economy and in many cases an important part of our community and our society. So we need to find a way to deal with the reality. And that is a path to rationalize their presence. Going to throw 12 million people out of this country? I don't think so. That's not going to happen. So they're here. So that's the amnesty question gets really foolish when you think about it in political sound bites. But when you begin to think about it in its complexity, in the reality of our communities and the families that are here, we need to figure out some way of dealing with that. Some want to become citizens. 6 years ago, I was meeting with the Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs in the Mexican government. His responsibility was North America. In other words, Mexicans in the United States. And he said, we've done polling, and about 17% want to become citizens. Another 17% want to stay. The rest want to come back home on a regular basis. They want to work and come back home to Mexico. So these are things we need to deal with. And we are so caught up in the politics of this. This is a great political issue. If you don't believe me, turn the television on tonight and listen to the last-minute gubernatorial ads.
I'd just like to say something about these jobs of gardening and so forth. These are jobs that students formerly, when they needed to earn money for schooling and whatever, were able to take. Many cities now don't have these opportunities for young people anymore. What's more, the immigration you referred to when the Germans and Poles around the 1800s and
1800s. Italians and Irish and a few others.
Yeah, they came. There was a limit to the number of years that they came. They didn't, you know, 10 or 15.
Not initially,
years.
But eventually,
the peak,
yes.
There was a peak at Ellis Island where they went
That's
up
correct.
And down. However, we see no leveling off.
No, in fact, we have. In fact, we have. We have immigration laws that limit legal immigration.
John, before you finish that, I need to make a short announcement for our radio audience.
Okay.
Reminder that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Congressman John Garamendi. And if you would like to finish up on the immigration issue, we'll move on to another question.
I'd like to finish the question, if I may.
Very quickly, sir.
Yeah. The other thing is we're in league, the corporations and the government are in league with the elite of Mexico. There are 16 billionaires in Mexico.
Yeah, you've already said this, sir. That may or may not be true, but the immigration policy of America, we need a comprehensive. I've outlined most of it as to whether the government, I don't believe our government is in league with those 16 people. Now, you may have some information. I'd be happy to take that information. But clearly, our immigration policy has to change. Okay? And in my view, has to be comprehensive. You've got to deal with each and every one of these pieces. Thank you very much for your question.
Congressman, I think it's a chance for me to ask one of my questions while we wait for someone else to come up to the microphone.
I was hoping I'd hear from you.
Could you have gotten away without hearing from me?
I don't.
We've had what the economists are calling this jobless recovery, which seems like an oxymoron to us lay people who aren't in Washington. A lot of the new jobs were created by the government through temporary census. What role should the legislature and Congress play in turning this around, or is this simply going to be a function of the market and we have to be patient?
No, we cannot be patient. We've got 10% or more of Californians out of work. They're losing their homes. They're losing their insurance. They're losing their ability to take care of their family. And I'm not patient, and I don't believe our government should be patient. I think we have to take action. The American Recovery Act, the stimulus bill really worked. You know, I know the Tea Party folks, they know it didn't work, but the fact is it did work. Together with even the bailout of Wall Street, as much as I think it was done wrong, actually worked. The rest of the world, the industrialized world, did the same thing and stabilized the world's finances. Now, I think we ought to go get a lot of that money back from Wall Street, and there are ways we could do that. But we need to continue, in my view, we need to continue to employ people. Listen, unless we are willing to accept people literally living in the street without food, without shelter, then we are going to find some way to support them. And we're doing that. We're doing that with unemployment insurance. We're doing that with COBRA extensions. We're doing that with various welfare programs, healthcare programs, and the like. I think that's part of being a human being, is to have that compassion and to provide it. I don't think that's the best way to go. If we're going to spend that money, I'd just as soon spend that money on employing people to do something. You mentioned gardens over here. Absolutely. Employ people to do the gardening, the community gardens, clean up the streets. Hopefully do it in fundamental investments that have long-term effect, like employ teachers, employ assistants and aides in the classroom. build classrooms, insulate classrooms, do the things that have long-term impact, build roads, build high-speed rail systems, build the kinds of things that employs people. It's traditional Keynesian economics, which was said by every government in the world, we need to do it. And interestingly enough, the conservative magazine, The Economist magazine, said last week in their editorial that America needs to do more stimulus. That is, put people to work. That's where I am. I want taxpayers rather than tax takers. We have an option here. Employ people. Do those jobs programs. I think that's necessary, and I think we need to do it again. And simultaneously, we need to take back the subsidies that we've been given to companies that have been offshoring people. We, over the last decade and a half, almost two decades now, have given tax breaks to companies as they move jobs offshore. Last week, 10 days ago now, we voted out of the House an end to those tax subsidies. No longer will corporations be able to get a tax break for sending jobs offshore. Now, the Senate needs to do the same thing, and perhaps they've already done it today. They said they're going to take it up this week. Good for them. Let's get it done. And by the way, the power of one in the Senate has to end. One senator can stop legislation. That's wrong, and there's been too much of that. So I can tell the Senate what to do.
Well, we have a question. Yes,
and
ma'am.
Actually, can I ask two quick questions? One is, you've already made reference to the savings that will accrue as the healthcare bill rolls out. But I would be interested, because we hear so much about the detriment that the deficit has to the long-term health of the country and even national security.
Yeah.
And so I'd like to hear your thoughts on other ways, and I think you've also alluded to some other ways in your presentation,
yeah,
but how some specific means for reducing the
yeah
deficit. And then the second question is, I'd like your thoughts on the and your position on the use of nuclear power and natural gas as part of our energy policy.
Nuclear power and?
And natural gas.
Natural gas, okay. With regard to the deficit, yes, we have to deal with the deficit. Now, in the 90s, I was very much a part of dealing with the deficit, reinventing government, and the Clinton administration's policies beginning in 1993 resulted in a surplus at the end of his administration. I think it was about $500 billion surplus. And had those policies continued, we would have been $5, $6 trillion reduction in the national deficit. So there are policies that really work. We actually, at the Department of Interior, when I was there, took the Department of Interior from 95,000 employees to 90,000 employees to 75,000 employees, the smallest it had been since the 1950s. There are ways to make government efficient. So efficiency and effectiveness at all your government services, wherever they happen to be, must be done. Incidentally, I'm going to be very partisan. The Republicans talk it, but they don't walk it. They actually increase the size of government during the Bush years. Okay? So that's kind of policy. It's tax policy and it's spending policy working together. We're in a world of hurt in this nation's economy today. And we're in a position in classic economics where we need to stimulate the economy. So we need to do that. We did it last year in 2009. We need to do it again this year. And there are multiple bills that are going through. For the life of me, $23 billion, most of it deficit spending. For what purpose? This is an issue before us right now. I'm going to vote on this hopefully this week. $23 billion. For what purpose? To keep employed 300,000 teachers in America. For me, that is a great investment. A great investment. Educating our kids is the single most important investment this country can make. Even more important than high-speed rail. We need to do that. It's a deficit thing for sure, but you've laid off 300,000 teachers. Okay? That's the kind of thing we need to do right now. And we need to, as I said, we increase the taxes on corporations that are offshoring jobs. I think we ought to go a step further, and I think we ought to go to Wall Street and get some of our money back. And the way I would do it, and this is not the favorite of the financial institutions, the banking industry in America have become the great gamblers. You know, they're not gambling on investing in a business with equity, as an investment banker would do in the past history, or with a loan, as a banker would do, they're gambling on derivatives. And it's become a computerized gaming game, gambling game, computerized. Instantaneous trades back and forth, more than $3 trillion moving back and forth. I got an idea.
Congressman,
one quarter of 1% of that. It's called a securities transaction tax, and it's on the gamblers at Wall Street. We're going to tax their gambling. $130 billion a year. What can we use that for? A lot of things. Yes.
I was just going to ask if that component was in the regulatory reform package. The
no.
House passed, the Senate
not yet.
In conference, so you're
it
hopeful.
Should be.
You're hopeful?
It should be. I mean, it reduces the volatility of the stock market, and it brings revenues in and discourages the kind of gambling that the Wall Street's doing. You take a look at where the profits are coming from Bank of America and Goldman Sachs. It's not on investing in businesses, as traditionally was done. It's investing in the gambling. It's called the trading activities. Microsecond back and forth. Anyway,
you asked
a question about nuclear.
Oh, go to nuclear. Yeah, we're running out of
nuclear
time.
Has to be part of our future. It has to be. 30 years ago, I had a major role in shutting down the nuclear industry in California. Okay? That was 30 years ago. And we need to rethink this. The world has moved on. We have a serious climate problem. We have a serious energy problem. I talked about that earlier. Nuclear has to be there. There are methods and there are technologies now that can actually consume the nuclear waste. It's called stage 4 nuclear reactors, integrated fast reactors. They've existed for some 30 years. We stopped the technological advancement of that in 1993. We need to go back and take a look at that. That's a way of dealing with the waste in a process. Is it safe? We need to be sure that it is. Stage 3 nuclear reactors are used throughout the world. These are light water reactors, stage 3, and the rest of the world is using them, and they've been safe for some 30 years now. So we need to put this back into the equation. It's not the only thing we should do. All of the renewables, biofuels, algae fuels, solar, wind, geothermal, all of those things have to be. We need to move away from carbon-based energy, which is the energy source of the 19th and 18th and 19th century. We need a 21st century energy source, and these are the renewables of all kinds.
I believe we're down to time for our last question, sir. So you have the honor.
John, you've been in state government for a number of years and now in federal government. And not directly involved in the subject of what I'm going to ask, but I'd like your opinion. When we came here 35 years ago, the education in California was supposed to be number one in the country, and now we're at the other end. And I'd like to have your opinion as to why. And the second part of that is it realistic to think federal government can do anything to solve whatever problems you think exist in education?
You have 2 minutes.
This is the great challenge for America. In the mid-80s, I undertook a study in the California legislature, how to keep California competitive in this century, the 21st century. We went and created and found, historically, 5 things that if we did these things well, every year, California would have a great future, not only economically, but social justice. The best education system in the world, the best research in the world, make the things that come from that research, because those are new, have a high profit margin, you therefore have a high wealth society. You have to have the infrastructure of all kinds. We didn't think about the internet at that time. And you got to be international. Those are the 5 things. How many of those are we doing today? Best education? No. We're not even close. The University of California, the day I left the legislature in 1990, spent $15,000 per person. We are now below $9,000 per person. And what do we get? We don't get the best. Great institution. But you got fees. It's now $25,000, $30,000 for a student to go there. Major, major problem. Same percentage reduction at the state university system and in the elementary and high schools. This is a non-starter. The most important investment, if we've got the 8th wealthiest economy in the world, If that economy is going to stay competitive, we have to make the investments in those five things. The most important of all is education. It is bad public policy. It is bad social policy. It is bad economic policy not to invest in education. We are starving. We are eating the seed corn of tomorrow's economy. It's got to stop. And we've got gubernatorial candidates out there that are spending $100 million saying we're going to go in exactly the opposite direction. The single biggest expenditure in California's government is education. And they want to reduce government. And I'm going, let me understand how this is going to work.
Congressman, I am so sorry, but we are out of time. I know that's one of your passionate issues, as we can tell. Our thanks to Congressman John Garamendi. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Lisa Vorderbriggen, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned.